The beginning of Parshas Bereishis is obviously so dramatic and so epic. Creation, Gan Eden, forbidden fruit, disobedience, punishment, Adam, Chava, murder. It's so dense and so dramatic. So much of our attention gets sucked into those first parts, and sometimes you don't pay enough attention to the conclusion. The conclusion is a little bit sad. We see humanity living under the terms of its double fall, the fall of Adam, the fall of Cain. Living sad lives, lives without much accomplishment, just children. The children who lived a little bit longer and they died, doesn't seem like they accomplished that much else. No progress, no communication, there's no conversation. Remember the first conversation is a strained conversation between Lemach and his two wives, and I'll talk about that a bit later. And I'll skip over Lemach for the meantime and go into that, or delve into that long lineage of people who lived and died. And finally, of course, the great hope. The great hope for humanity. His name is Noach. He's the son of Lemech. And he's named Noach. The first time we're given reasons that he's given a name. That people were given a name. Chai was called Aim Kol Chai. Shais is named because HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered a second child in place of a substitute child. Of course, Lemech's two children... we're not really sure how the name reflects who they were and what they accomplished, but in Noach's case, it is reflective not of his life, but reflective of the period he lives in. Now, what happens? So Rashi fills in the blank that even before Noach rescued his family, at least there was some rescue for humanity. Man was chugging along, suffering the great curse of Kotz v'dardar tatzmiach lach, it's going to be difficult to have children. Women were suffering. Man was cursed. And probably the key word that captures all the suffering and agony and the misery is the word itzavon. Remember, the word itzavon describes woman's delivery, childbearing, be'etzev tel divanim. But to a degree, it almost serves as the theme for humanity in general. Harba arba etzvonech. I will augment, Hashem says. I will exacerbate your suffering. It sounds like everyone has itzavon. Everyone has this suffering, this sadness, atzuv. But yours will be worse because it's associated with heronech. And then to underscore the point, be'etzev tel divanim. And now Noach arrives, and he's called Noach because zeh, Yenachamenu mi ma'aseinu umi itzvon yadenu. He will be menachemas, ze yenachamenu, min ha'adama asher erer Hashem. So you would think that this is a clairvoyant, prescient name. This is the one who's going to rebuild humanity. This is the one who will console the world for the loss of the human race. From the land that God will curse, Asherah Hashem. It could be forward, it could be a prescient name, because he will rescue humanity, at least by repopulating the earth. Not true. And the tip-off is the word itzvon. Itzvon sends us backwards in Bereishis, not forward to Noach. Returns us to the curse that Hashem had already delivered the land, not the curse that he will deliver to the land, Tishachesa Aretz, but the curse that he already delivered, and of course the word itzvon is the connecting word. And Rashi, of course, recognizes that. Rashi says that before Noach, or during Noach's period, it's not clear whether this name was prescient because they knew that something was happening or there was a process that had begun. It sounds like the process had begun because if you look back, it's not exactly clear how long before Noach humanity had discovered metal utensils and metal objects. If you look back, remember there are two parallel genealogies and the dating or the schedule is not exactly clear. There's the lineage of Cain and then there's the lineage of Shais. So Cain has a child named Chanoch and Chanoch has a child named Irad. Irad gives birth to Mechuyael, Mechuyael to Metushael, Metushael to Lamech. Lamech is the seventh generation after Cain. His son is called Tuval Cain. He refers to Cain. He says It says Kivashayim Yukam Kayin Vilemach Shivim Mishava. Maybe I'll talk about that Rashi in a few moments. But that's the lineage of Kayin. And at some point in that lineage, one of the children begins to discover bronze and copper and to refine it and to manufacture. Tzila, one of Lamech's wives, gives birth to Tuval Kayin. This is Lamech and Tzila have a child named Tuval Kayin, named after an ancient grandfather, Tuval Kayin. And he's Lotesh Kol Choresh Nechoshes Ubarzel. They're able to smooth and to work and to have a bellows and to shape and craft bronze and copper items. So man had already learned utensils and tools, but he hadn't seemingly applied them yet to agriculture. Now in Parakeh, we're delivered Shesh's lineage. Shesh has an entire different lineage. His son is in Chanoch. Chanoch is Cain's son. His son is Enosh. Enosh gives birth to Kenan. Kenan gives birth to Mahalalel. Mahalalel gives birth to Yared. Yared gives birth to Chanoch. You know a little bit about Chanoch. Chanoch gives birth to Metushelach. Metushelach gives birth to Lamech. Not Lamech, but Lamech. Lamech or Lamech, it's really the same word. Lamech or Lamech, not the Lamech who's part of Cain's lineage, but the Lamech who's part of Shesh's lineage, he gives birth to Noach. So Lamech is Noach is Noach ben Lamech, but not the Lamech that had two wives. It's a little confusing unless you're paying attention. But the Lamech who had two wives, part of Cain's lineage, that Lamech gave birth to a child that had perfected bronze and copper work. During Noach's period, it seems like just if we space the generations, it's a little bit later than Lamech and his two wives and his children. At that point, Rashi says, they were able to create and to manufacture kli macharisha, tools and instruments to help the agriculture process, literally hoes and plows. And initially the land was arid, was unfertile, was rocky, wasn't productive. And somehow, in the days of Noach, this abated. Now, it seems from Rashi that the abatement of this punishment wasn't that the term had ended and that the curse had expired, but that they crafted agricultural tools that allowed them to process the land and prepare the land in a way that drew the fertility from the land despite the divine curse. And it sounds that way not just from the way Rashi provides this discovery of plows as a way to escape or to surpass and to solve the divine curse, but even in the name of Noach. We very quickly read the word Noach because of the word Menachem and Nichum Avelim and the phrase Zeh Yenachameinu, as if Noach is the consolation for suffering. We know that Noach is the consolation for the destruction of an entire planet, entire human race, but it's also the consolation for the destruction of the earth. Rashi refuses this. In the end of Rashi, he gets very grammatical. He should have been called Noach. He should have been called Menachem if the root was consolation. The translation, according to Rashi, is not consolation, but yaniach, to release, to relieve. Rashi says, during the time of Noach, nacha, v'zei nachameinu, yaniach mimenu et itzvon yadenu. He will release from us our suffering, our torture, our agony, that key word of itzvon yadenu. So Noach is not just consoling people because it's a time of consolation, but he, and in this case, the events surrounding his life, whether he was responsible for this great leap forward in industrialization, creating metal tools to facilitate agriculture, or others were, and it was just associated with his name. Either way, he is being meniach the itzvon. He's setting aside, he's releasing this curse. So it sounds from Rashi that the curse didn't just end naturally because a certain time period had elapsed, but that humanity, whether Noach or others, were able to, through ingenuity, create the type of progress and human conditions to circumvent HaKadosh Baruch Hu's original curse. Namely, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's curse is not a death sentence. It's not a prison sentence. It's a challenge. Until now, you lived in Gan Eden. Until now, nature readily colluded readily collaborated. The food was available. The fertility was just oozing and gushing and effusing. Now the fertility will be sunk deep into the earth. Initially, until you adjust, you'll meet with hardship and suffering. But if you're able to advance the human condition, you can develop tools, technology, know-how to still survive and to actually capture the fertility that was once yours naturally. It's a whole different way of viewing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response to sin, and it's also a whole different way of viewing human progress, even outside of moral, spiritual, religious progress. This is a religious development. Noach doesn't yet discover HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He will. He is described as Noach Ish Tzadik Tamim Hayah B'Darasav. So there's a moral tint to Noach that we meet in next week's Parsha, but not in this week's Parsha. In this week's Parsha, either we see Noach as this inventor, as Einstein, as Edison, or we see people acting Edison-like during that period and creating and thereby transcending HaKadosh Baruch Hu's curses. And we don't often think of human progress as desirable from a religious standpoint or as a way for humanity to try to resolve some of the handicap that HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered after the curse. Now I mentioned the other Lemech, not the Lemech who was Noach's father, but the Lemech who was seventh generation after Cain, Metushael's child. So Lemech has a very interesting marital life. And we're given a front row seat to Lemech's marital life. Torah describes that he takes two wives, Vayikach. So, first of all, this is really the first time that we see something resembling marriage. Remember, Adam and Chava never have a ceremony of marriage. Perhaps they don't need it. There are only two people on the earth. HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers the Kala to the Chasan. But Cain doesn't really know what type of marriage he has. When he gives birth, Vayeda Kain es Ishto. So he has an Isha. There is a woman there. Obviously, you can't give birth without a female. But are they married? Have they undergone a ceremony? Do they live together? Lemech takes two wives, and they live together. Vayikach lo Lemech shtei nashim. Shem achas Adav, v'shem ashin es Tzila. So humanity is not just procreating, but creating relationships, and presumably there's some society that sees this relationship and sanctifies it and respects it. However, Rashi provides a slightly more sinister description. There was a disassociation between sex and marriage. There were two wives. One wife was a sexual object. In this case, Tzila, from the word sale. She sat next to her husband. She was protected. She was cared for. She was precious. The other woman, in this case, Ada is the Targum Rashi says, of Sura, being sent away, being discarded. She was merely a baby-making mechanism. And she was a family maker. Now, the irony is twofold. First of all, they each have a child. Okay, Ada has two children. Tzila has one child, but evidently, whatever birth control they were using wasn't effective for Tzila. Second of all, they don't seem to be at odds with one another in the same way that, let's say, some of the other co-wives in Sefer Bereishis are. Towards the end of the pasuk, they seem like co-conspirators. They each walk away from their husband, and Lemech has to plead with them in ways that sound like Parshas Hazinu, Shman Koli, Neshe Lemech, Hazeni Mersi. They're grouped together as Neshe Lemech. But certainly, we see the first seeds of the depravity and the debauchery of the Mabul. Rashi writes, Kachaya Darkam, Shall Dor HaMabul. Remember, we're not yet up to the Dor HaMabul. If we're just following, this is seven generations from Cain. It's pre-Dor HaMabul. But you get a sense that this is what invites or incites the Dor HaMabul, invites some of the moral depravity because people are disassociating sexual encounter with marriage. Very similar to our own generation, very similar in our generation. Certainly was the introduction of the birth control and other social and sexual revolutions that, at least the way it was presented, liberated women from the tyranny of marriage and allowed them to engage in whatever intimate activity they wanted to, unfettered by, and of course allowed men as well. This is not something we sanctify interaction, healthy sexual interaction, and it's part of our lives as Ovdei Hashem, and it's part of the Torah. but it's clearly framed and internalized through marriage and the separation of the two, as we would call it, the creation of not premarital sex, but non-procreational sex, without any hint or aim towards procreation, is something which is critiqued even at this early stage, even before there are mitzvahs. It's not the way to build a society. It leads to a complete collapse of society. Now, what happens in this relationship between Lemech and his wives? How does it go sour? Well, it probably goes sour because it's not a healthy dynamic. A sexual object and a baby-making machine. At some point, you don't want those two profiles to be split from each other. But it goes south because Rashi tells the story that Lemech kills his great grandfather. Lemech's father is Metushael, his grandfather is Mechuyael, his great grandfather is Irad, his great great grandfather is Hanoch, who died early, and his great 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 grandfather is Cain. So these people lived a long time, hundreds of years, and they were great great grandfathers. What happens is, at least the story Rashi says, that Tuval Cain and Lemech were hunting. Lemech went blind. Probably we imagine they lived longer than we live, and their eyes just didn't keep their fitness, so they went blind at a certain point. So his son is leading him into this hunt. They had to hunt for their food. And they see something that looks like an animal, and Tuval Cain, his father's eyes, tells his father to pull his bow and kill the animal. Remember, they already had bows. Pull back the bow and kill the animal. And all of a sudden, by accident, they realize that it's their great-great-grandfather, Cain. And Lemech is so upset that he somehow kills his son, Tuval Cain. Rashi says, Safak has been obinam. He claps his hands. He was a very strong person, this Lemech. At this point, his wives are unwilling to forgive him because he's a murderer. And he's murdered his great-great-grandfather, of course, and he's also murdered one of their children. Again, keep in mind, you would expect, at least the way Rashi presents the story, that it's Tzila that's disenchanted with Lemech. In fact, you can imagine Ada being very happy, because Ada was the discarded wife, Ada was the surah, Ada was sent away, she wasn't attractive, she was allowed to just, without being cared for, she was just seen as this mother of children, and now her co-wife, Tzila, sounds like she has only, it sounds like she had only one son. She had a daughter called Na'ama, but she had one son called Tuval Cain. Now Tuval Cain is dead, but they're both angry. They're both alienated from Lemech. Now, Lemech responds by saying as follows, Ki shiv asayim yukam Cain v'lemech shivim v'shiva. Hard, what does it mean that Cain killed 7 times 7 and Lemech 70 and 7? Rashi says that essentially, and I'm summarizing parts of Rashi, Lemech's claim to his wives were, it was all just accidental. I'm not an intentional murderer. I'm not homicidal. It was an accident. Why can't you forgive me and return to me and carry on our lives? V'chi'ish asherakti lefitzi hu ne'erag. Am I a potzea? Am I a mezid? He says, Ki ish harakti lifti v'yela l'chaburati. Have I killed this ish, this man Cain, as a petza, and have I killed this yela Tuval Cain in an intentional fashion l'chaburasi? I'm a shogeg. I'm not a mezid. I'm unintentional, and I deserve your forgiveness. Now it's not clear that they offer it to him. You would imagine they would offer it to him without him asking for it. It's part of a normal, healthy marriage conversation. Communication. You don't have to say it so poetically. It sounds like this is Custer's last stand. It's Lemech's last stand. They're about to walk away finally, and he makes one last plea to them. You'd expect them just to forgive him. Part of it is the unhealthy marital relations that he himself sowed or created by separating these two wives into different functions. The communication is off. Part of it is they live in a very harsh period in which it's not clear what forgiveness means. Remember, this is pre-Har Sinai and pre-Tshuva, and in very famous Medrash that Adam didn't even know he could perform Tshuva. It's not clear whether Adam performs Tshuva. Even Cain's Tshuva is very lukewarm. So There seems to be a world in which there's an exacting sense of justice and an exacting sense of consequence, a harsh world, a world that exacts a toll, that demands a price, in which offenses are dealt with immediately. And what does it mean to have a world that can't forgive one another? What's the relationship between that world and the world of the Mabul? If there's a world that can't allow forgiveness, then at what point does it release people from moral responsibility? Remember, forgiveness at all levels creates moral retention. We know we can be forgiven. We know there's recourse. We know there's recovery. So we remain morally active and morally engaged and morally aware. Once there's immediate consequences, and a lot of people, when they struggle religiously, the guilt builds. And at a certain point, it just builds and it erupts. And they just say, I can't take this anymore. And they see themselves and they cast themselves as unredeemable and unforgivable and beyond and expelled. And it's cathartic. Okay, now that I know that I have no choice for tshuva, let me just live my life the way I'd like to live my life, freely and hedonistically and self-absorbed. So how do you get from a world that has a difficult time forgiving people to a world that collapses morally? So it's interesting to have this conversation. Remember the Torah, there are hundreds of years that elapse, thousands of years elapse between Adam and Noah, about 1,000 years. And Torah records who created what, and this conversation, which seems so mundane, because it evidently possesses a purpose. And the purpose is, again, to show the attempts to create marriage, the failed marital institution separating a sexual object and a baby maker or baby creator, the lack of communication or healthy communication, or communication in Sefer Bereishis is not a slam dunk. It's not built in. Communication is difficult. People don't talk to one another properly until Migdal Bavel, where they talk to each other too successfully and with too much precision. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to intervene. Maybe I'll talk about that next week.